Zelda looked up from the bath she was mixing, and when she saw what her mistress was doing, snapped a prim reprimand. Katinka laughed and stuck out her tongue, but dropped her hand and stepped into the bath. With a luxurious sigh, she sank into the hot, perfumed water, until only the thick coil of golden hair on top of her head showed above the rim of the bath. Zelda fussed over her, lathering soap on a flannel, wiping and washing, murmuring endearments and cackling at her mistress's replies. Suddenly she rocked back on her heels and gave another instruction, in response to which Katinka stood up, and the soapy water cascaded down her body. Her back was turned to Hal, and now the rounds of her bottom glowed pinkly from the hot water. At Zelda's instructions, she moved compliantly to allow the old woman to soap down each leg in turn. At last, Zelda climbed stiffly to her feet and shuffled out of the cabin. As soon as she was gone, Katinka, still standing in the bath, glanced over her shoulder. Again, Hal had the guilty illusion that she was looking directly into his own staring eye. It was only for a moment, then slowly and voluptuously she bent. Her buttocks changed shape at the movement. Katinka reached behind herself with both hands. She laid those small white hands on each of her glowing pink buttocks and drew them gently apart. This time, Hal could not choke back the little abandoned cry that rose to his lips, as the deep crease of her bottom opened to his feverish gaze. Zelda bustled back into the cabin, bearing an armful of towels. Katinka straightened, and the enchanted crevice closed firmly, its secrets hidden once more from his eyes. She stepped from the bath, and Zelda draped a towel over her shoulders that hung to her ankles. Zelda loosened the coil of her mistress's hair and brushed it out, and then braided it into a thick golden rope. She stood behind Katinka and held a gown for her to slip her arms into the sleeves, but Katinka shook her head and gave a peremptory order. Zelda protested, but Katinka insisted, and the maid threw the gown over the stool and left the cabin in an obvious pet. When she was gone, Katinka let the towel drop to the deck, and naked once more crossed to the door and slid the locking bolt into place. Then she turned back and passed out of Hal's sight. He saw a fuzzy pink blur of movement in the clouded mirror, but could not be sure what she was doing, until abruptly and shockingly her lips were an inch from the opposite side of the peephole, and she hissed viciously at him, "You filthy little pirate!" She spoke in Latin, and he recoiled as though she had flung a kettle of boiling water in his face. Even in his confusion, though, the taunt had stung him to the quick, and he answered her without thinking, "I am not a pirate. My father carries letters of mark." "Nay, don't you dare contradict me." Confusingly, she was switching between Latin, Dutch, and English. But her tone was sharp and stinging as a scourge. Again he was stung into a reply. I did not mean to offend you. When my noble husband finds out that you have been spying on me, he will go to your pirate father, and they will have you flogged on the tripod like those other men this morning. I was not spying on you, liar." She would not let him finish. "You dirty, lying pirate." For a moment she had run out of breath and insults. "I only wanted to..." Her fury was recharged. "I know what you wanted. You wanted to look at my kaichi." He knew that was the Dutch word for kitten. "And then you wanted to take your cock in your hand and pull it..." "No!" Hal almost shouted. How had she known his shameful secret? He felt sick and mortified. "Quiet. Zelda will hear you," she hissed again. "If they catch you, it will be the lash." "Please," he whispered back. "I meant no harm. Please forgive me. I did not mean it."
"Nay, then show me. Prove your innocence.
Show me your cock."
"I can't." His voice quivered with shame.
"Stand up. Put it here next to the hole so that I can see if you are lying."
"No, please don't make me do that."
"Quickly, or I will scream for my husband to come."
Slowly he came to his feet. The peephole was at almost exactly the same level as his aching crotch.
"Now show me. Open your breeches."
Her voice goaded him. Slowly, consumed by shame and embarrassment, he lifted the canvas shirt, and before it was fully raised, his penis jumped out like the springy branch of a sapling. He knew she must be nauseated and speechless with disgust to see such a thing. After a minute of thick, charged silence that seemed the longest in his life, he began to lower his skirt over himself. Instantly she stopped him in a voice that seemed to him to tremble with revulsion, so that he could hardly understand her distorted English words.
"Nay, nay, do not cover your shame. This thing of yours condemns you. Do you still pretend you are guiltless?"
"No," he admitted miserably.
"Then you must be punished," she told him. "I must tell your father."
"Please don't do that," he pleaded. "He would kill me with his own hands."
"Very well. I shall have to punish you myself. Bring your cock closer."
Obediently, he pushed his hips forward.
"Closer, so I can reach it closer."
He felt the tip of his distended penis touch the rough wood that surrounded the peephole, and then shockingly cool, soft fingers closed over the tip. He tried to pull away, but her grip tightened and her voice was sharp.
"Stay still."
Katinka knelt at the bulkhead and threaded his glands through the opening, then eased it out into the lamplight. It was so swollen that it could barely fit through the hole.
"Nay, nay, do not pull away,"
she told him, making her voice stern and angry, as she took a firmer grip upon him. Obediently he relaxed and gave himself over to the insistent pressure of her fingers, allowing her to draw his full length through the opening. She gazed at it, fascinated. At his age she had not expected him to be so large. The engorged head was the glossy purple of a ripe plum. She drew the loose prepuce over it, like a monk's cowl, and then pulled back the skin again as far as it would go. The head seemed to swell harder, as though on the point of bursting, and she felt the shaft jump in her hands. She repeated the movement, slowly forward and then back again, and heard him groan beyond the panel. It was strange, but she had almost forgotten the boy. This mannequin she held in her hands had a life and existence of its own.
"This is your punishment, you dirty, shameless boy."
She could hear his fingernails scratching at the wood as her hand began to fly back and forth along the full length of him, as though she were working the shuttle of a weaver's loom. It happened sooner than she had expected. The hot, glutinous spurting against her sensitive breasts was so powerful that it startled her. But she did not pull away. After a time, she said, "Do not think that I have forgiven you yet for what you have done to me. Your penitence has only just begun. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
His voice was ragged and hoarse. "You must make a secret opening in this wall." She tapped the bulkhead softly with her knuckle. "Loosen this panel so that you can come through to me, and I can punish you more severely. Do you understand?"
"Yes,"
he panted. "You must conceal the opening. No one else must know." "It is my observation," Sir Francis told Howe, "that filth and sickness have a peculiar affinity one for the other. I know not why this should be, but it is so." He was responding to his son's cautious inquiry as to why it was necessary to go through the onerous and odious business of fumigating the ship. With all the cargo out of her and most of the crew billeted ashore, Sir Francis was determined to try to rid the Howl of vermin. It seemed that every crack in the woodwork swarmed with lice, and the holds were overrun with rats. The galley was littered with the black pellets of their droppings, and Ned Tyler had reported finding some of the stinking, bloated carcasses rotting in the water casks. Since the day of their arrival in the lagoon, a shore party had been burning cordwood and leaching the ashes to obtain the lye, and Sir Francis had sent Aberley into the forest to search for those special herbs that his tribe used to keep their huts clear of the loathsome vermin. Now a party of seamen waited on the foredeck, armed with buckets of the caustic substance. "I want every crack and joint of the Howl scrubbed out, but be careful," Sir Francis warned them. "The corrosive fluid will burn the skin from your hands." He broke off abruptly. Every head on board turned towards the distant rocky heads, and every man upon the beach paused in what he was doing and cocked his head to listen. The flat boom of a cannon shot echoed from the cliffs at the entrance to the lagoon and reverberated across the still waters of the wide bay. "There it is, the alarm signal from the lookout on the heads, Captain," shouted Ned Taylor, and pointed across the water to where a puff of white gun smoke still hung over one of the emplacements that guarded the entrance. As they stared, a tiny black ball soared to the top of the makeshift flagpole on the crest of the western headland, then unfurled into a red swallowtail. It was the general alarm signal, and could only mean that a strange sail was in sight. "Beat to quarters, Master Daniel," Sir Francis ordered crisply. "Unlock the weapons chests and arm the crew. I'm going across to the entrance. 4 men to row the longboat, and the rest take up their battle stations ashore." Although his face remained expressionless, inwardly he was furious that he should have allowed himself to be surprised like this, with the masts unstepped and all the cannon out of the hull. He turned to Ned Taylor. "I want the prisoners taken ashore and placed under your strictest guard, well away from the beach. If they learn that there is a strange ship off the coast, it might give them the notion to try to attract attention." Oliver rushed up the companionway with Sir Francis's cloak over his arm. While he spread it over his master's shoulders, Sir Francis finished issuing his orders. Then he turned and strode to the entry port, where the longboat lay alongside, and Hal was waiting, where his father could not ignore him, fretting that he might not be ordered to join him. "Oh, very well, then," Sir Francis snapped. "Come with me. I might have need of those eyes of yours." And Hal slid down the mooring line ahead and cast off the moment his father stepped into the boat. "Pull till you burst your guts," Sir Francis told the men at the oars, and the boat skittered across the lagoon. Sir Francis sprang over the side and waded ashore below the cliff with the water slopping over the tops of his high boots. Hal had to run to catch up with him on the elephant path. They came out on the top, 300 feet above the lagoon, looking out over the ocean. Although the wind that buffeted them on the heights had kicked the sea into a welter of breaking waves, Hal's sharp eyes picked out the brighter flecks that persisted among the ephemeral whitecaps, even before the lookout could point them out to him. Sir Francis stared through his telescope. "What do you make of her?" he demanded of Hal. "There are 2 ships," Hal told him. "I see but one." "No, wait, you're right. There is another, a little further to the east. Is she a frigate, do you think?" 3 masts," Hal shaded his eyes, "and full rigged. Yes, I'd say she is a frigate. The other vessel is too far off. I cannot tell her type." It pained Hal to admit it, and he strained his eyes for some other detail. "Both ships are standing in directly towards us." "If they are intending to head for Good Hope, then they must go about very soon," Sir Francis murmured, never lowering the telescope. They watched anxiously. "They could be a pair of Dutch East Indiamen still making their westings," Hal hazarded hopefully. "Then why are they pushing so close into a lee shore?" Sir Francis asked. "No, it looks very much as though they are headed straight for the entrance." He snapped the telescope closed. "Come along." At a trot, he led the way back down the path to where the longboat waited on the beach. "Master Daniel, row across to the batteries on the far side. Take command there. Do not open fire until I do." They watched the longboat move swiftly over the lagoon, and Daniel's men drag it into a narrow cove where it was concealed from view. Then Sir Francis strode along the gun emplacements in the cliff and gave a curt set of orders to the men who crouched over the culverins with the burning slow match. "At my command, fire on the leading ship. 1 salvo of round shot," he told them. "Aim at the waterline. Then load with chain shot and bring down their rigging. They'll not want to try manoeuvring in these confined channels with half their sails shot away." He jumped up onto the parapet of the emplacement and stared out at the sea through the narrow entrance, but the approaching vessels were still hidden from view by the rocky cliffs. Suddenly, from around the western point of the heads, a ship with all sails set drew into view. She was less than 2 miles offshore, and even as they watched in consternation, she altered course and trimmed her yards around, heading directly for the entrance. "Their guns are out, so it's a fight they're looking for," said Sir Francis grimly, as he sprang down from the wall. "And we shall give it to them, lads."
"No, father," Hal cried. "I know that ship."
"Who?" Before Sir Francis could ask the question, he was given the answer. From the vessel's maintop, a long, swallow-tailed banner unfurled. Scarlet and snowy white, it whipped and snapped on the wind.
"The Croix Patée," Hal called. "It's the Gull of Murray. It's Lord Cumbrae, father."
"By God, so it is. How did that red-bearded butcher know where we were here?" Astern of the Gull of Murray, the strange ship hove into view. It also trained its yards around, and in succession altered its heading, following the buzzard as he stood in towards the entrance.
"I know that ship also," Hal shouted on the wind. "There, now I can even recognise her figurehead. She's the goddess. I know of no other ship on this ocean with a naked Venus at her bowsprit."
"Captain Richard Lister it is," Sir Francis agreed. "I feel easier for having him here. He's a good man, though God knows I trust neither of them all the way." As the buzzard came sailing in down the channel, past the gun emplacements, he must have picked out the bright spot of Sir Francis's cloak against the lichen-covered rocks, for he dipped his standard in salute. Sir Francis lifted his hat in acknowledgement, but grated between his teeth, "I'd rather salute you with a bouquet of grape, you Scottish bastard. You've smelt the spoils, have you? You're come to beg or steal, is that it? But how did you know?"
"Father," Hal shouted again, "look there in the futtock shrouds. I'd know that grinning rogue anywhere. That's how they knew. He led them here."
Sir Francis swiveled his glass. Sam Bowles. It seems that even the sharks could not stomach that piece of carrion. I should have let his shipmates deal with him while we had the chance. The Gull moved slowly past them, reducing sail progressively as she threaded her way deeper into the lagoon. The goddess followed her at a cautious distance. She also flew the Croix Patée at her masthead, along with the cross of St. George and the Union flag. Richard Lister was also a knight of the order. They picked out his diminutive figure on the quarterdeck as he came to the rail and shouted something across the water that was jumbled by the wind.
"You are keeping strange company, Richard."
Even though the Welshman could not hear him, Sir Francis waved his hat in reply. Lister had been with him when they captured the Heilige Nacht. They had shared the spoils amicably, and he counted him a friend. Lister should have been with them, Sir Francis and the Buzzard, while they spent those dreary months on blockade off Cape Orgullis. However, he had missed the rendezvous in Port Louis on the island of Mauritius. After waiting a month for him to appear, Sir Francis had been obliged to accede to the Buzzard's demands, and they had sailed without him.
"Well, we'd best put on a brave face and go to greet our uninvited guests," Sir Francis told Hal, and went down to the beach as Daniel brought the longboat across the channel between the heads.
As they rowed back up the lagoon, the two newly arrived vessels lay at anchor in the main channel. The Gull of Murray was only half a cable's length astern of the Resolution. Sir Francis ordered Daniel to steer directly to the goddess. Richard Lister was at the entry port to greet him as he and Hal came aboard.
"Flames of hell, Frankie! I heard the word that you had taken a great prize from the Dutch. Now I see her lying there at anchor."
Richard seized his hand. He did not quite stand as tall as Sir Francis's shoulder, but his grip was powerful. He sniffed the air with the great florid bell of his nose, and went on in his singing Celtic lilt.
"And is that not spice I smell on the air? I curse myself for not having found you at Port Louis."
"Where were you, Richard? I waited 32 days for you to arrive."
"It grieves me to have to admit it, but I ran full tilt into a hurricane just south of Mauritius. Dismasted me and blew me clear across to the coast of St. Lawrence Island."
"That would be the same storm that dismasted the Dutchman," Sir Francis pointed across the channel at the galleon. "She was under jury rig when we captured her."
"But how did you fall in with the Buzzard?"
"I thought that as soon as the goddess was fit for sea again, I would look for you off Cape Orgullis, on the off chance that you were still on station there. That's when I came across him. He led me here."
Well, it's good to see you, my old friend. But tell me, do you have any news from home?
Sir Francis leaned forward eagerly.
This was always one of the foremost questions men asked each other when they met out here beyond the line. They might voyage to the furthest ends of the uncharted seas, but always their hearts yearned for home. Almost a year had passed since Sir Francis had received news from England.
At the question, Richard Lister's expression turned somber. 5 days after I sailed from Port Louis, I fell in with Win Song, one of Her Majesty's frigates. She was 56 days out of Plymouth, bound for the Coromandel coast.
So, what news did she have?
Sir Francis interrupted impatiently.
None good, as the Lord is my witness. They say that all of England was struck by the plague, and that men, women, and children died in their thousands and tens of thousands, so that they could not bury them fast enough, and the bodies lay rotting and stinking in the streets.
The plague! Sir Francis crossed himself in horror. The wrath of God!
Then, while the plague still raged through every town and village, London was destroyed by a mighty fire. They say that the flames left hardly a house standing.
Sir Francis stared at him in dismay.
London burned? It cannot be. The king, is he safe? Was it the Dutch that put the torch to London? Tell me more, man, tell me more. Yes, the black boy is safe, but no, this time it was not the Dutch to blame. The fire was started by a baker's oven in Pudding Lane, and it burned for 3 days without check. St. Paul's Cathedral is burned to the ground, and the Guildhall, the Royal Exchange, 100 parish churches, and God alone knows what else besides. They say that the damage will exceed £10 million.
10 millions? Sir Francis stared at him aghast. Not even the richest monarch in the world could rise to such an amount.
Why, Richard, the total crown revenues for a year are less than 1 million. It must beggar the king and the nation.
Richard Lister shook his head with gloomy relish. Oh, there's more bad news besides. The Dutch have given us a mighty pounding. That devil, De Ruyter, sailed right into the Medway and the Thames. We lost 16 ships of the line to him, and he captured the Royal Charles at her moorings in Greenwich Docks and towed her away to Amsterdam.
The flagship, the flower and pride of our fleet. Can England survive such a defeat? Coming as it does so close upon the heels of the plague and the fire?
Lister shook his head again. Oh, they say the king is suing for peace with the Dutch. The war might be over at this very moment. It may have ended months ago, for all we know.
Let us pray most fervently that that is not so. Sir Francis looked across at the Resolution. I took that prize barely 3 weeks past. If the war was over then, my commission from the Crown would have expired. My capture might be construed as an act of piracy. Ah, the fortunes of war, Frankie. You had no knowledge of the peace. There is none but the Dutch will blame you for that.
Richard Lister pointed with his inflamed trumpet of a nose across the channel at the Gull of Murray.
It seems that my Lord Cumbrae feels slighted at being excluded from this reunion. See, he comes to join us.
The Buzzard had just launched a boat. It was being rowed down the channel now towards them. Cumbrae himself standing in the stern, the boat bumped against the goddess's side, and the Buzzard came scrambling up the rope ladder onto her deck.
Frankie, he greeted Sir Francis, since we parted, I have not let a single day go past without a prayer for you.
He came striding across the deck, his plaid swinging, and my prayers were heard.
That's a bonny wee galleon we have there, and filled to the gunwales with spice and silver, so I hear.
You should have waited a day or two longer before you deserted your station.
You might have had a share of her.
The Buzzard spread his hands in amazement.
But, my dear Frankie, what's this you're telling me? I never left my station. I took a short swing into the east to make certain the Dutchies weren't trying to give us the slip by standing further out to sea. I hurried back to you just as soon as I could, but then you were gone.
Let me remind you of your own words, sir.
I am completely out of patience. 65 days are enough for me and my brave fellows. My words, Frankie,
the Buzzard shook his head.
Your ears must have played you false. The wind tricked you. You did not hear me fairly. Sir Francis laughed lightly. "You waste your talent as Scotland's greatest liar. There is no one here for you to amaze. Both Richard and I know you too well." "Frankie, I hope this does not mean you would try to cheat me out of my fair share of spoils." He contrived to look both sorrowful and incredulous. "I agree that I was not in sight of the capture, and I would not expect a full half share. Give me a third, and I will not quibble." "Take a deep breath, sir." Sir Francis laid his hand casually on the hilt of his sword. "That whiff of spice is all the share you'll get from me." The buzzard cheered up miraculously and gave a huge booming laugh.
"Ha, ha, Frankie, my old and dear comrade in arms, come and dine on board my ship this evening. We can discuss your lad's initiation into the order over a dram of good Highland whisky."
"So it's Hal's initiation that brings you back to me, is it? Not the silver and spice?"
"Oh, I know how much the lad means to you, Frankie. To us all. He's a great credit to you. We'll all want him to become a knight of the order. You have spoken of it often. Isn't that the truth?"
Sir Francis glanced at his son and nodded almost imperceptibly.
"Well, then, you'll not get a chance like this again in many a year. Here we are, three Nortanier knights together. That's the least number it takes to admit an acolyte to the first degree. When will you find another three knights to make up a lodge out here beyond the line?"
"How thoughtful of you, sir. And, of course, this has no bearing on a share of my booty that you were claiming but a minute ago." Sir Francis's tone dripped with irony.
"Ugh, we'll not speak about that again. You're an honest man, Frankie. Hard but fair. You'd never cheat a brother knight, would you?"